This is an ABC podcast.
As fires burn across the country and more regions brace for catastrophic conditions, we ask what this means for the months ahead. Indonesia's been busy since the live cattle export ban was lifted.
The meat will be more tender and we can see that it's good for everyone.
We head to a feedlot in Sumatra to find out what's changed with new animal welfare regulations. And the group of can-do dialysis patients raising money for a new facility.
We're so used to having services taken away from us. To have something this significant introduced, yeah, be amazing.
I'm Michelle Crowther, filling in for Sinead Mangan, and this is Australia Wide. Well, fires continue to burn across the country, with five states and the ACT facing fire weather warnings. More than 10 properties have been damaged in bushfires in South Australia today, and over 30 people treated for minor fire-related injuries. In New South Wales, the ABC's Peter Riley has spent the day with the Rural Fire Service.
We've seen fires come up to emergency warning and stay, and some to watch and act and go down. At one stage, we had 7 watch and act fires burning across New South Wales early this afternoon. As we speak, we've got 1 emergency warning, which is a fire that's burning in northern New South Wales in the Richmond Valley at Mile Creek Road at Bora Ridge. That fire is very substantial in terms of size. We have 2 other fires at Watchenack, El Dorado Road at Yarralla, and Gosford's Mountain, which is burning in the Hawkesbury in the Wallumbine National Park. That's close to Sydney and has actually been burning for some time, as you would know. The latest information we have from the New South Wales Rural Fire Service is that there are 61 fires still burning, 30 are not contained, and we have 57 advice level fires along with those warnings that I talked about. There's about 1,600 personnel in the field, nearly 600 vehicles, and 31 remote area teams, which are those that are going and usually dropped in by helicopter somewhere and fight the fire by hand. They don't take trucks in there. And they're actually trying to use hand tools to work on the fires in those areas. So it's a significant area that's been impacted. There's been thousands of homes that have been saved, thousands of outbuildings that have been saved. Unfortunately, 500 homes have been destroyed since Friday the 8th of November, and 178 damaged, and 972 outbuildings have been destroyed since the 8th of November, and 385 damaged. So when you put that into perspective, so far this season, there's 612 homes that have been destroyed, but more than 7,900 facilities and buildings that have been actually saved. So the Rural Fire Service crews and those agencies that are supporting them have been doing amazing work in the field as these fires have burned over 1 million hectares of ground across New South Wales.
That's the ABC's Peter Riley in New South Wales. And the first Code Red fire day in almost a decade was declared in parts of Victoria as the state braced for extremely hot and windy conditions today. Emergency Management Commissioner Andrew Crisp wasn't mincing words.
This is the absolute worst conditions for us in terms of grass and bushfires.
And here's the ABC Central Victoria reporter Beth Gibson with the latest.
So in Victoria today, we've seen more than 60 fires across the state, and there have been 4 emergency warnings, 6 watch and acts. The most serious fire at the moment, according to the Emergency Management Commissioner, Andrew Crisp, is in Strathallan, which is just south of Echuca. So we've heard that there's been a loss of a hay shed and a structure, possibly a house. 6 families were relocated. And there are actually 5 different fires in the area that are now being investigated by Victoria Police. There's also a watch and act fire at Mills Lane in Natty Yallock. That one is a grass fire that's not yet under control. And there are a number of fires across the state, but those are the most serious ones at the moment. As a result of the extreme weather we've had here, it's been incredibly, incredibly hot and windy. There were widespread power outages across Victoria, currently looking at about 60,000 houses and businesses without power, 20,000 in Bendigo, that's the biggest affected area. And of course, there's also been a thunderstorm asthma warning for people across the central, north central and northern country district. And we've been told there has been a cool change that's slowly filtering across the central Victorian region at the moment. But with that cool change is also expected to be dry lightning. So emergency management are warning people that the danger isn't over. And in fact, dry lightning can be an even more serious risk of bushfire than hot weather. So it won't be until about 11 or 12 o'clock at night when that's expected to pass.
You're listening to ABC Australia Wide.
Well, the sheer number of fires across so many states at this early stage of the season raises some ominous questions. If things are this bad now, what does it mean for summer and for the future generally? Well, Amanda Leck is Executive Director of the Australian Institute for Disaster Resilience. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Michelle, and to your listeners.
Can you give us a little context on how this year compares with other years in terms of number and range of fires?
So we're certainly seeing more fires occur earlier in the season. And so we saw some early fires in Queensland throughout August and September. We're also seeing significant fire activity in New South Wales. So the fires that we're experiencing now in Australia are happening earlier in the season than would normally have been anticipated several years ago.
So that doesn't augur well for summer.
We're certainly concerned, and we're very much trying to work with the community to understand that they need to be prepared for these fires. They need to understand the risks that they face and take action, because the fire and emergency services can, of course, only do so much. And with such widespread fires occurring across two states now and also into South Australia most recently, we need people to share that responsibility with fire agencies and take action now to prepare themselves and their properties.
If we're seeing such widespread fires, what does it mean for resources in terms of firefighting? I mean, if you're looking at aerial firefighting resources, for example, and a number of different regions needing them, how does that play out?
So AIDA's leading partner is the National Fire Council, and the National Fire Council is responsible for the National Resource Sharing Centre and the National Aerial Firefighting Centre. So we have systems and processes in place to share aerial firefighting assets, such as the very large air tankers you see and the helicopters and so on. But we also have good systems and processes in place to move firefighters, fire trucks and other incident management personnel across borders to deal with the risks in the various states and territories.
Should we be worried about what happens if there aren't enough?
I don't think we should be worried. I think that we should understand that what we're seeing now is significant fire behaviour in many states occurring at the same time. And as I said earlier, communities need to be prepared to take action to protect themselves and to listen to the warnings that are put out by the fire and emergency services and to respond appropriately to those warnings.
Amanda Leck, thanks for your time this afternoon.
Thanks, Michelle.
And Amanda Leck is Executive Director of the Australian Institute for Disaster Resilience.
This is ABC Australia Wide.
Well, 8 years ago, the Australian government banned live cattle exports to Indonesia in a decision that shocked the cattle industry on both sides of the Timor Sea. You'll remember the issue that sparked the ban was animal welfare, and new regulations were swiftly introduced under the Exporter Supply Chain Assurance System, or ESCAS, to ensure the welfare of animals exported from Australia. Well, Australia Wide presenter Sinead Mangan travelled to Indonesia to investigate the state of the live export trade with Indonesia since the 2011 trade ban. And she starts at a feedlot in Sumatra.
If we can find somewhere shady to do an interview, that would be good.
The weather is hot and humid here at the Juang Jaya feedlot outside of Lampung in Indonesia. The cattle are housed in huge open sheds, and the only giveaway that you're in a feedlot in Indonesia, not in Australia, are the palm trees that are not very far from here on the property. The feedlot houses several thousand cattle, and all of those cattle are from Australia, mainly from the Northern Territory and from Western Australia. And I'm here with feedlot manager William Bulo.
This is our latest version of the place where we feed and fatten our cattle. And you see the cattle here. They are eating, happy, and enjoying their time here.
When did these cattle arrive from Australia?
This already here about 70 days. And they need another 30 to 50 days before we slaughter them.
Can you tell me about what you feed them while they're here? Because I've seen there's lots of different feedstuffs that are used for the cattle.
Yep. The feedlot in Indonesia mainly feed the cattle with byproduct or the waste of the agricultural industry. We mainly feed them with the onggok or tapioca waste, tapioca chips, palm meal, kernel meal, copra meal, and then the molasses and green chop as the forage.
Why is there such a sweet smell in the air?
Because of the molasses, and because we want to make sure that the cattle have a very good circumstances and situation here, so they don't feel the stress and just enjoy the place they live.
There was a live cattle trade ban in 2011. How did that change things for you here at the feedlot?
Yeah, we understand that cattle is the same as human. They have the right to be treated humanly or nicely. So now we understand that in every journey that the cattle have to travel, we make sure that they are in the good animal welfare standard. And the other thing about the ban also make us able to improve our operation in the feedlots. Like we can now trace every cattle, we can now trace the performance, we can now trace what they've been through in the whole process, and then also in our buyer perspective, it is easier to handle the cattle in the abattoirs, and it's safer for human and the cattle. So we are in a very supportive stand for the animal welfare application.
Tell me about what these tags are. I can see every Brahman cow that's staring at me right now has a tag on its ear. What does that tell you?
That's to tell their ID, because we need to trace them from where they coming from in Australia until where they will end it and serve us with the good quality meat. So we have to put ID in their ear and make sure that we understand what journey every cattle have going through.
Was that introduced as part of the SCAS system after the live cattle trade ban?
Yeah, it's one of that. And the good things about that is, as I explained before, it also improved the accuracy of our recording here. So now we can record the identity of every cattle, the genetics, the color, the age, the whatever happened to them, whether and their performance, and also for the most important things is to understand what is their travel or their journey that they already passed through and where they end. And we make sure that every cattle is on the line of the SCAS that we already agreed to do.
When the footage of the cattle in the abattoir was made public, was it a shock to you that this footage was around?
Yeah, that was a shock. At the time, I'm still very young in the industry. I'm still working here for a couple of years, so I don't really understand what's happening. But I in the position of supporting, that we have to increase our understanding and our application on the animal welfare. Now, if you ask to our team or our butcher in the abattoir, will you go back to the period before the animal welfare regime? They will say no. I want doing my operation as the animal welfare standard, because that's much better, much safer, and producing a better quality cattle.
Why is it a producing a better quality cattle? Can you explain why that happened?
Because the cattle less stressed, they are treated very calm, and the low stress make the quality of the meat produced from a cattle is good. So the meat will be more tender, and we can see that it's good for everyone.
How has the Indian buffalo meat affected things?
The Indian buffalo meat take over nearly 40 to 50% of our market, so it's affect seriously.
Are you concerned at all that Australian Australian cattle farmers will look for different markets if it gets too difficult here?
We already have a very long relation, and we consider our Australia buddies as a friends, as a mate. So it will be very sad if they move from Indonesia. I expect that we still have a relation in the future.
That's just Sinead Mangan speaking with William Bulow at his feedlot outside of Lampung in Sumatra, Indonesia. And you can read her feature on the state of the cattle trade between Australia and Indonesia since 2011 on ABC Rural.
ABC Australia Wide.
Travelling from a small town to a larger regional or metro area is a reality faced by many renal dialysis patients. But in North Queensland, those patients, their supporters and politicians are working to change that. As Sophie Wainwright reports, a group from Charters Towers west of Townsville is raising funds for a satellite dialysis unit in the town.
Patricia Kennedy is getting off the bus at the Townsville Hospital for critical kidney treatment.
Afternoon.
Since April, the 49-year-old has been taking the three-hour round trip from Charters Towers twice a week. She's over it.
Leave at 8, on the machine for 4 hours. I usually get off about 2:30 and then wait around from 2:30 to 4 for the bus to come back home, which arrives back in Charters Towers at 5:30.
So a whole day?
A whole day, yes.
Marnie, in the car, please.
By the time she's home, Miss Kennedy doesn't have the energy to keep up with her 8-year-old daughter and 7-year-old granddaughter.
Next day, sometime I can get out of bed, sometime I can't. You just got to try and push yourself to. But otherwise, I'll just explain to them, I'm too sick, can't do anything. Can you try and help yourself and do it.
Alrighty, anything else? My last question is... Oh, sorry.
She's joined a new group of about 20 people, largely made up of patients and their supporters, who want a service closer to Charters Towers.
We need all the support we can get and get all this community behind this.
It's just horrendous. We really need dialysis here.
I think it'd be quite a coup for a town like Charters Towers to have an introduction of a health service like dialysis, when rural townships all over Australia are needing this.
That voice belongs to Tracy Murphy. She travels 3 times a week to Townsville with her husband, who requires dialysis. Miss Murphy says she helped establish the group with the local state member, Robbie Catter.
Originally, we thought we were actually lobbying to get dialysis here. Now we feel like we're making positive steps forward and we're just doing whatever we can to help.
The group has been convening regularly, discussing the viability of running a local service, the community already raising $2,500.
We're sending out to mining companies, big companies, anyone who might be able to afford a small donation to help us get going. We've also applied for grants. You know, we might even have to do the odd chook raffle, just to show our support, you know, and help buy some of the equipment. And I just don't see how the health department can say no to us after doing that.
She says the funds will demonstrate community support, which will help build the Townsville Hospital's business case. Tony Mooney is the board chair and has been part of the group meetings.
I will work as hard as I can. I'll give it a red hot go to make sure that we get something happening both there and in Ingham and for all of those other locations as well.
4 patients from Charters Towers and 4 from Ingham, north of Townsville, would qualify to use a satellite unit in their towns. Mr Mooney says that's the magic number.
A year ago, there was only 1 patient that would qualify, so it was really not sustainable. Once you get to that figure of 4, it changes the dynamics of how it will work, and that's why we are where we're at right now. And if we have to put some of our own funds into it from our retained earnings or our surplus each year, very hard to get that. But if we can, well, that's what I'm prepared to consider.
In June, the Queensland Government launched a plan to improve kidney health and services by 2026, including providing more opportunities for treatment in small and remote communities. It's something Miss Murphy believes Charters Towers will receive.
We're so used to having services taken away from us. To have something this significant introduced, yeah, be amazing.
Sophie Wainwright with that story.
You're listening to ABC Australia Wide on ABC Radio.
Well, Indigenous content is a part of the education curriculum that teachers often struggle to teach. But a new national project hopes to make it easier to deliver and more accessible for teachers and students. The Our Land, Our Stories resource is a series of books, cards and digital content that's been developed in consultation with more than 35 Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people from around the country. The aim is to help primary school teachers bring more Indigenous content into their classrooms. The ABC's Megan Kinnamont with this report.
Australian teachers are required to embed Indigenous content into the curriculum, but many struggle to find material, or they lack the confidence to share Indigenous stories in their classrooms. Queensland teacher Sally Lawrence is a specialist curriculum developer for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander materials. She has helped create the Our Land, Our Stories teacher guides.
Sometimes teachers have tried in the past and they may have been culturally inappropriate in what they've done, and then somebody from the community's come up and highlighted, you know, where they may have fallen short or gone wrong, and so people are then reluctant or hesitant to try again because the first time or the time that they have tried, they've, say, gotten into trouble. So we want to remove those fears. So my part of this resource was to develop the teacher resource books. I've wanted to basically hold the hand of the teacher to give them confidence. So the way it's set out, I flag any of those cultural protocols, any of those things that may be done wrong in the past and why you're reluctant to engage. I've flagged those at the start. So basically saying, don't stuff up. If you follow these protocols, you'll be fine.
So you've given us step-by-step instructions. Sure. And that has come directly from communities themselves.
Yeah, so it's been a thorough process, and that's been the beauty of working with IATSIS with this series, is that everything that we've written has been double-checked and double-cross-checked by IATSIS and their Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander workers. And it's also been taken back out to community, where community have had the opportunity to evaluate what's been written and suggest any changes that needed to be made. Been up to the Torres Strait and showed the educators up there, and we've got some of the elders in tears. They're just so excited to see their culture, their communities and the people that they know represented in these education resources, and they're saying this is a long time overdue.
One of the Aboriginal elders contributing to the series is Bachelor Elder Angari or Fraser Island traditional owner Nene Bird. She has shared Dreamtime creation stories that appeal to a young audience.
So I have the butterfly story, which is for the lower primary section. This time the land is made and different creatures are appearing on the scene. There is Caterpillar, who comes across a small spirit called Barabe, resting in a shady bush. Barabe is our first artist and paints everything that needs painting, like the grasses, plants and trees. Caterpillar offers to carry the paints for Barabe, but you also have characters there in the scene like Willy Wagtail. So it goes through the whole scenario of Willy Wagtail trying to play a trick on Caterpillar, and he doesn't succeed. So the Malon comes down and helps out by turning Caterpillar into a butterfly. So then he can carry the paints on his back so Barabe can continue painting the flowers and the trees and the sunsets in the west.
To have those stories being taught far and wide, is that important to you?
Extremely important, because it doesn't matter which environment that you live in. These are about creation of the land and the people and the animals and the waters. And if we look after the environment together, then all those children right around Australia will be able to learn the lesson from these stories.
In Canberra, Gold Creek school teacher Jane Marshall is seeing the positive effect of teaching Indigenous material in her early childhood classroom.
You know, when our children draw or when they go for a walk on a nature walk, they might make a comment like, oh, it's so disappointing, the Ngunnawal people will be so unhappy, there's so much rubbish around. And so that embedding means that there's a respect level also, like already, just because of the simple concepts that you're teaching.
Megan Kinnamont with that report, and that's Australia-wide for today. I'm Michelle Crowther, filling in for Sinead Mangan. If you're in a bushfire-affected area, please stay safe and keep up to date by listening to ABC Radio. Time for the news.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. You can discover more ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.